Welcome back to the Institute for European Studies, and all Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year also to Jamie. We're very happy to see you back in the last but one of your lectures here at our Institute. This time on failed and failing states. The next one will be next week's Thursday. That will be on cybercrime. But today, failed and failing states. The floor is yours.
Anthony, thanks very much, and also to all of you, belated but nonetheless sincere, happy New Year. I know that for most of you who stayed in Brussels over the Christmas holiday, the problem was more fouled transportation systems than fouled or failing states. But fortunately, things are moving again, and therefore, welcome back. I suppose when I thought of today's lecture, I was sort of struck by an inconsistency. This is lecture number five, as Anthony said, the penultimate of the series. And yet when I think of my own personal life over the last 15 or 20 years, when I think of what NATO has been doing, and when I think of the security challenges that we've been talking about in this series, it does perhaps strike me as a little bit illogical that failed and failing states should be number five and not number one. Because the obvious reason is that, as anybody knows who has been dealing with security policy over the last 20 years, the international attention, the debate on security, the deployment of armed forces has been overwhelmingly focused on this issue of failed and failing states. We've had, as you all know, a massive, almost an explosion of peacekeeping and peace support of stabilisation missions, not only by the United Nations, but also by NATO, by the European Union. We've had the emergence of regional organisations such as the African Union or the Organisation of West African States. And if you look around the world today, in 2010, there are at least 40 such peace support operations ongoing. Virtually every week, the UN, as this week with Haiti, calls on the international community to provide yet more peacekeepers, in the case of Haiti, 3,500, in order to either deal with state failure or a type of natural disaster like an earthquake or a massive hurricane or a flood, which, if left undealt with, could in fact destabilise a state and lead to a failing state as well. And of course, if you also look at the casualty statistics, although I spent some time talking about terrorism, if we look at the United States last year, 14 people alone, still 14 too many, but 14 people alone died from terrorist attacks, most in one single incident, which took place, you recall, in an army base at Fort Hood in Texas, whereas there were 14,000 murders in the United States last year. But failed states, for the last 20 years, have been producing, on average, 2,000 deaths a day, from the various civil wars that are often the consequences of state failure. And the vast majority of these people are, of course, civilians and, indeed, women and children. So failed states is still the largest cause of violent death in the world today, and that scenario is likely to be true for the foreseeable future. What we also see is that there is a direct correlation between what the Oxford economist Paul Collier calls the bottom billion. The 1 billion of humanity, of course, that live in absolute poverty, political instability and failed states. According to some recent research done by Collier and his team, 73% of the poorest people on this earth live in lands where civil wars are either ongoing or have recently terminated. 76% of the bottom billion live in states characterised by bad governance. 29% of the bottom billion live in states where there are resource conflicts ongoing. And 30% of the bottom billion live in states which have hostile or what, as he calls, bad neighbours. At the same time, what we are witnessing, and this of course is well documented, is a gradual shift in geopolitics from wars between states to wars within states. Between 1946 and 1959, there were on average four major wars a year, but only 11 minor civil conflicts a year. Then between 1960 and 1991, the height of the Cold War, there were on average 17 interstate wars a year and 35 minor. Today, since 1991, the average has worked out at 5 major wars, but 27 minor conflicts. Now, the good news, if you like, from this particular picture is that, therefore, state failure is less likely to lead to the involvement of the great powers and a general war than at previous times in history. We don't need to worry any longer about the Sarajevo syndrome of an assassination on a street corner in Sarajevo by a Serb nationalist, leading to the involvement of the great powers and the First World War. But of course, for the bottom billion, or the 2 billion people, indeed, about one-third of the world's population that live in failed or failing states, obviously the news is not so good in terms of human security and the propensity to violence. Now, this, of course, this situation has produced an agonising question that NATO and most other international organisations, most of the Western countries, have faced over the last 20 years, which is essentially to intervene or not intervene. A few years ago, a well-known American strategic scholar, Edward Luttbach, wrote an incendiary article in Foreign Affairs magazine saying, "Let wars burn." Luttbach's thesis was that we should not intervene, because if we did intervene, we tended, A, to become the enemy. Every liberation force risks ending up as an occupation force, as you well know. Secondly, Luttbach argued all we did was freeze the conflict rather than resolve the conflict, or we prevented the winner from winning and we stopped the loser from losing. So the frustrated winner was angry with us, but the loser believed that he could fight on through a Western intervention, and did not realise that he had lost and therefore was not prepared to make peace. So Luttbach was very much arguing that let wars burn was the best approach, because you would only have peace when you had the absolute victory of one side over another. Well, this could be an interesting academic thesis, ladies and gentlemen, but I think that all of you, and particularly those of us in the bureaucratic policy-making circles, would argue that that's simply not an option. We have both moral imperatives and strategic imperatives to do our best with the resources we have not to let wars burn, but to stop conflicts. Now, the moral reason, of course, has been this shift in international law that we have seen over the last two decades towards security of countries giving way to security of people, security of individuals, defence of populations as the focus rather than defence of territory. The great British Prime Minister, William Ewart Gladstone, pronounced in a famous speech in the 19th century that the security and the liberty of the tribeswoman in Afghanistan was as sacred in the eyes of Almighty God as yours or mine. In other words, the sense of a common humanity. In those days, in the days of Gladstone, this was probably simply good political rhetoric. But today, the evolution of international law has not only created a right to intervene, personalised, of course, some years ago by Bernard Kouchner, of course, le droit de l'ingérence humanitaire, as it became known in French, but indeed a duty to intervene. Since 2005, the United Nations General Assembly has approved the responsibility to protect. In other words, state sovereignty is no longer absolute. It's conditional upon state behaviour. For example, not committing human rights violations, refraining from genocide, not playing host to terrorist organisations, or not illicitly developing weapons of mass destruction. And the United Nations Security Council, albeit with some exceptions, which we'll mention in a moment, has increasingly been willing, of course, to mandate either the UN itself to mount those interventions, or alternatively, to give the subcontracting role to an organisation like NATO or the African Union or the European Union and others. The CNN factor has obviously contributed enormously to this phenomenon as well. One thing that we no longer can claim is ignorance. The days when the W.B. Stead, the Times correspondent in Bulgaria, could witness the atrocities committed by the Ottomans, and it took 9 days for his article to work its way back to the Times in London. In the age of instant communications, blogs, Twitter and so on, that's impossible. We know immediately. And often governments are driven as much by the pressure of public opinion. We must stop this into intervening as by a calculus of their own strategic interests as well. At the same time, alongside the humanitarian motive, we have increasingly become aware that failed states are not simply something that we condemn morally, but that we feel we do not need to do anything about. We're increasingly seeing the link with our own security. I mean, Afghanistan, of course, is the prime example. The failed state turned into a black hole, which played host to the Taliban, to Al-Qaeda, to terrorist training camps. It became a sanctuary where these groups were, of course, able to organise attacks, which then, in a joined-up, globalised world, rapidly produced the results in New York or Washington or London or wherever. And, of course, today the focus now is that those groups have taken themselves to the northwest frontier provinces of Pakistan, or alternatively have now establishing themselves in Somalia or Yemen in particular, or other countries as well. So the sense of the humanitarian imperative to help suffering people is increasingly aligned with a strategic imperative that these interventions are a kind of forward Article 5, if you like, to use NATO's collective defence clause, a way of dealing with the threat at source so that one does therefore not have to suffer the consequences on one's own territory. So, as a result, interventions are not easier to implement, but they are certainly easier to authorise than they would have been in the days of the Cold War, when state sovereignty, enshrined in Articles 2.4 or 2.7 of the UN Charter, were considered to be absolute. But this has posed three particular difficult questions. The first one is whether to intervene. Of course, here one needs, first of all, a mandate, as I've said, from the United Nations, most cases given. But when NATO intervened in Kosovo in 1999, as all of you know, it did not have an explicit mandate from the UN Security Council, not because the majority of the UN was against NATO, far from it, but because one country in particular, which also is a veto member of the Security Council, would not have given its approval. Nevertheless, NATO intervened, and all countries in NATO had to reassure Javier Solana, the Secretary General, that they had a sound legal basis. Of course, the legal basis could have been different. For some, it was previous UN resolutions. For others, it was the Genocide Convention, for instance, or conventions on the punishment of the crime of genocide as well, or basic humanitarian law. I mention this because it has created a debate, which I think is going to be with us for some time, which is something which maybe from a technical point of view is illegal, or is it legitimate? I happen to believe that NATO's intervention in Kosovo in 1999 was both legal and legitimate, but it does raise the question of whether law, international law as such, is keeping up with the precedent of practice as we go from one intervention to another. Incidentally, this is also the case with the responsibility to protect. It's a good principle, but how do we implement it? We know that the responsibility to protect applies to demonstrated genocide, but would it also apply, for example, to what happened in Burma a couple of years ago with the floods, when the government of Burma dragged its feet in terms of allowing international aid agencies access to help those people who were displaced by flooding? It was not genocide. There was no sort of systematic persecution going on. But would the government refusal to accept responsibility activate the responsibility to protect? So whether to intervene, I think, is still going to be largely dependent upon how one determines legitimacy in these cases. Secondly, it will also depend on factors over which we have little control in advance. For example, like leadership the mobilization of public opinion. I well remember a meeting with Boutros-Ghali, the former Secretary General some years ago of the United Nations, in New York in 1994, where Boutros-Ghali was frankly very angry with Manfred Werner, the then NATO Secretary General, because the Allies, though not NATO at the time, but the individual Allies, had about 35,000 troops in Bosnia, where Boutros-Ghali was claiming that very few people actually were dying. He said fewer than nine a day. And they had put no troops in Angola, where, according to Boutros-Ghali at that meeting, 10,000 Angolans were dying every month from the civil war that was going on. Or he expressed his frustration that he had not been able to find anybody to go on a peacekeeping mission to Mozambique. There was a sense of unfairness that the West was fully prepared to intervene on its doorstep, where Europeans were the victims, but was not prepared to intervene where other groups, Africans in particular, were suffering far more. Was this a case of cultural, political double standards? Of course, therefore, ladies and gentlemen, whether to intervene is probably going to never be quite satisfactory. We will never be totally consistent. We will probably sometimes do the right thing in one place, but as in the case of Rwanda a few years ago, not then do the right thing in another. But the question will always be, because we cannot intervene everywhere, does that mean that we should not intervene at least where we can? The second question is how intervene. Here, of course, the question is always, do we intervene basically with a transformation agenda? In other words, that we are going to build Switzerlands in Afghanistan or in Kosovo or in Bosnia or in Chad or wherever, that we are going to effect a root and branch political transformation, such as what the United States attempted after 2003 in Iraq, to leave behind a transformed state like Germany or Japan after World War II, which would then become an ally and never again an adversary. I think in the wake of the costs of Afghanistan and the difficulties, we're increasingly backing away from that very overambitious agenda, which anyway makes the mistake of believing that we can impose a Western model on cultures or religions or countries that fundamentally want something different and want to go their own way. But on the other hand, we also know that the quick in and quick out approach to interventions, such as we saw in East Timor a few years ago, where the Australians went in but left very quickly, often means that the war restarts. Academics have shown that about 50% of all interventions give way to a new round of civil war within a decade. And the Australians then had to go back in to East Timor a second time, which they did successfully, and to stay a lot longer. So how transformative should our agenda be? Secondly, of course, there is this whole issue of, do you intervene with very large forces? Do you take over the state and run it as a kind of international trusteeship, similar to what we had with the mandates of the League of Nations between the two world wars, where the international community takes all of the decisions and keeps all of the power to itself, exemplified by Lord Paddy Ashdown in Bosnia a few years ago, who had the silver bullet clause, the absolute bond powers to hire and fire? Or do we go in with a very small footprint, a modest force, giving the ownership to the locals, as we've done in Afghanistan, to show to the people that we're not an occupation force and to give them the responsibility for their own affairs? We have discovered that neither solution, either the big footprint or the small footprint, is totally satisfactory. And then finally, when to intervene. I think the problem here, as we've discovered over the last few years, is that if we wait for a moral mandate, in other words, if we wait for genocide to have taken place or massacres to have occurred, if we wait to be absolutely certain that the situation is becoming very bad, we have a moral mandate, yes, nobody questions our intentions, but it's often too late. The fighting has started, the hatred is intensified, political leaders have decided on military victories, territory has been seized, which nobody is prepared to hand back. The ethnic cleansing, as in the Balkans, cannot be reversed. You cannot put Humpty Dumpty back together again as he once was. On the other hand, it's very difficult to convince politicians that something might go wrong in a certain country next week and they should intervene now. The UN, in fact, has conducted very few preventive deployments in its history. One notable exception was in 1994 in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. But that still, as I said, is the exception rather than the rule. So we then have to first solve the questions, whether to intervene, how to intervene, when to intervene. Next, of course, we have to address this problem of the incessant demand for international security forces. The United Nations, between 1945 and 1990, authorised only 16 peacekeeping operations. Peacekeeping wasn't even thought of in the UN Charter. Since 1990, in other words, since the end of the Cold War, the UN Security Council has authorised 48, and I think with Haiti last week, the figure is now 49, peacekeeping operations. The cost has escalated from about $1.5 billion in 1990 to around $8 billion a year that the UN now spends for peacekeeping forces. In January 08, there were over 100,000 UN Blue Helmets in the field. This is an increase of 600% over the last 20 years. Indeed, if you look around, it's what is remarkable is that in 2007, no fewer than 117 states in the world, out of a total of 192, were contributing to a peace support operation, whether under a NATO flag or as a coalition of the willing or under the UN or the EU or on some other organisation. And others have become involved. In the 10 years of the European Security and Defence Policy, the EU has launched 23 missions. And since it began intervening beyond its territory in 1992, NATO has launched 15 operations. And as I mentioned, other structures have become more involved. At the same time, the cost of these interventions, particularly when done by the West, which is four times more expensive than the UN, by the way, the costs have escalated. This week, something very significant happened in the United States. The costs of the Iraq conflict and Afghanistan went above the $1 trillion mark for the first time. In other words, the United States has spent on Iraq and Afghanistan at the moment, and in proportionate dollar terms, about half of what it spent winning the Cold War in the period from 1945 to 1989. A few years ago, Joseph Stiglitz, former vice president of the World Bank, brought out a book called A $1 trillion War, predicting these costs, and everybody accused him of gross miscalculation. The latest figures from the Congressional Budget Office is that the US is likely to go towards $2 trillion a year before these operations have effectively ended. And this year, for the first time, Afghanistan is now costing the United States more than Iraq. It's running at about $300 billion a year. The cost of deploying one US soldier in the surge recently decided by President Obama is calculated at about anywhere between $500,000 and $1 million per soldier per year. Therefore, the cost of the 30,000 extra troops is going to be in the region of about $30 plus billion dollars. These are incredible sums. And one of the questions that I want to try to ask in a while is to what degree having to pay such enormous costs for interventions is sustainable in the long run, if we're going to stay in this business, and if there are cheaper options for doing these things quicker and more efficiently on the table. Nonetheless, what is clear is that the phenomenon of failed states is going to be with us from some time to come. The Foreign Policy magazine, which I'm sure you're all readers of, does every year composes an index of failed and failing states. It monitors 177. It basically concludes that about one third of this number, 60, are failed or failing states. The top seven for the last few years, it hasn't really changed much, have been Somalia, no surprises, Zimbabwe, Sudan, 4 million internal refugees from the conflict between North and South in the past decade, Chad, Congo, where the UN estimates about 5.4 million deaths since 1998. Iraq, although one could argue that that probably is now increasingly stabilising, and notwithstanding all of the good efforts of NATO and other organisations since 2003, Afghanistan. On the watch list as rapidly failing and going from failing to failed states, we have Cameroon, Guinea, Yemen, which incidentally has the world's fastest growing population, but where one half of the population of 23 million lives on less than $2 a day, a state which is running out of water and which gets 90% of its revenue from its oil. The problem is, though, that it's running out of oil as well. Ethiopia, Eritrea, Guinea-Bissau. In other words, we have 40 to 60 chronically failed or failing states, which, as I've said earlier, represent 2 billion people. Now, this, of course, brings us to the question of where these failing states are likely to be positioned. We are seeing, in fact, it's interesting, since the Second World War, a shift in the focus of world poverty away from Asia and increasingly towards Africa. Africa has 10 of the world's 20 worst performing states. 10% of the global population, only 1% of the world trade. And this is despite the fact that in the last 20 years, $500 billion of aid have been invested in Africa alone. We still have a situation where 3,000 children die every day of malaria and 40 million children don't go to school. If you exclude South Africa and Nigeria from the equation, the World Bank estimates that the African economy is the equivalent of this country, Belgium. And I think that one of the things that we are going to see is an increasing focus of international peace support operations and peacekeeping over the next few years in favour towards Africa. Now, what explains, therefore, the phenomenon of the failed state, as in Africa today? First of all, we have, of course, demographic pressures. Population pressures. The world population is currently, as you know, 6 billion. It's calculated to stabilise around 9 billion towards the end of the century. That is not in itself the significant figure. The significant figure is that there is this disproportionality between enormous growth of population in the poorest parts of the world. I just mentioned Yemen, and the stagnation, of course, in the developing countries. And most, of course, of these poor people will increasingly be focused in cities. 65% of the US population lives in cities, but their average income is $13,000 a year. If you extrapolate this to the weakest, the bottom billion states of the world, you see that also today 65% live in cities as well, but with an average income which goes from $400 to $1,000 a year. Take another statistic. Some of the countries in the bottom part, although not all, because I have here a statistic that if you have Bangladesh, Egypt, Indonesia, Nigeria, Pakistan, Turkey, combined population today, 242 million. In 1950, the population of those countries were 242 million. Today, it's 886 million, and by the end of the next decade, it's calculated to rise by another 475 million. In the meantime, if you take the six most developed largest countries in the world, the rise is only estimated, including with immigration, to be 44 million. So in other words, it's not the absolute population figures which are important here, it's the fact that the demographic pressures are increasingly in the urbanized areas of the poorest countries of the world. And that, of course, is fertile breeding ground for despair, extremism, terrorism, and whatever else. So that's the first problem. The next problem, of course, is the existence of refugees and internally displaced people. The third element in failing states is ethnic grievances. Those states in Africa, like Tanzania under President Nyerere, that have made a major effort over the years to create a national identity, a national language, have been much more stable, even with fewer resources and lower poverty levels, than those states with very large resources, but which have had far greater social inequalities. I recommend all of you who are interested in a study here to read Michaela Rong's book, which is called It's Our Turn to Eat. It's Our Turn to Eat, where she basically sees the economic problem as one group wanting to capture power in order to have access to all of the economic resources, including through graft and corruption, that the rival group has had in the past access to. In other words, it's our turn now to have the upper hand. It's our turn to control the resources. It's our turn to eat. And governments, of course, quite openly push all of the resources and to that particular group, which is their group and which has voted them into power. So that too, I think, is an explanation of what has happened. Economic grievances are rivalries as to who controls the resources. We have uneven development, of course. We have the state as delegitimized, as not being able to provide essential services. It's calculated that the average Kenyan pays 16 bribes every year. And you may have seen even this week coming out of Afghanistan an incredible report, which is that one quarter of the Afghan GDP, $2.3 billion a year, goes in bribes. And the average Afghan pays nine bribes every single year. So the inability of the state to deliver basic services, corruption, and then, of course, finally, the consequences of an outside intervention as well. Now, governance, of course, therefore, is the key to success. Between 1960 and 1992, it's calculated that 60% of Africa's rulers left office early, and often not through democratic means. So establishing proper governance is the key, and that doesn't mean just having elections. In fact, Paul Collier, to quote him again, the very famous economist from Oxford, calculates that elections, in the absence of the rule of law, for instance, in the absence of anti-corruption, elections actually harm a state's ability to function and deliver rather than help. We have, of course, the effects of climate, but then again, Asia too has hot climates but has still been able to develop. We have, of course, issues like colonial inheritance. That's true. Many economists argue that Africa, for instance, has too many countries because state effectiveness is easier in large countries rather than small countries, but that, of course, is the consequence of the colonial inheritance. We have, of course, resource greed and rivalries. Congo has particularly suffered from this, where 11 other African countries have been dragged into Congo's conflict since the year 2000, and 85% of Congo's diamonds have been exported illegally and illicitly by many of those other countries as well. It was said in the United States, you remember some years ago when Bill Clinton was on his first election campaign, it's the economy, stupid. And that applies to failed states as well. And I'll speak about this in a minute. We often speak about peacekeeping. We speak about the development of civil society. We speak about, you know, organising elections, for example. Education, yes. But the key factor in determining state failure or state rehabilitation is the ability to establish a proper functioning economy. This is why I come to my next point. There is no fatality about failed states. There is often a sense of hopelessness that a state, once failed, cannot be rescued, that poverty is, if you like, an endemic condition that has to be accepted. But Asia was as poor as Africa in 1950, after the Second World War. In 1940, Argentina was richer than Italy. Or think of Ireland, which in the 60s had a GDP which was only about 40% of the EU average. Today, notwithstanding the financial crisis, the GDP of Ireland is 140% of the EU average. I'm not, of course, ladies and gentlemen, trying to pretend for 1 minute that Ireland is an equivalent to a poor landlocked African country at the moment. But I think the example of East Asia, where 30 million people have been pulled out of poverty in the last 20 years as a result of globalisation, does show that even countries which do not have natural resources can still grow at remarkable rates. For example, absolute poverty in East Asia dropped in the last 25 years from 58% to 15%, according to the World Bank. In South Asia, from 52% to 31%. In Latin America, by 10%. But in Africa, absolute poverty increased by 50%. That can't just be explained by malaria or climate or the absence of the air conditioning that allowed the southern states of the United States to start taking off 20 years ago economically. Yes, geography, climate, resource levels are important, but they in themselves do not determine whether states are destined to succeed or fail. So I think we have to look at the experience of Asia to realise that it is in fact possible to rescue definitively failed states. It's very much a matter of leadership. It's very much a question, as Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize economist, has pointed out, of moving from aid to economics, of anti-corruption, of opening markets, of welcoming direct foreign investment, of the rule of law, of these kind of things. Even in Africa, you have states which have similar geographical circumstances to others. One thinks of Botswana, for example, but which have still been quite remarkable success stories in achieving growth levels. So, ladies and gentlemen, if there is a problem of failed states, they're going to be with us for a long time to come, and if there is a security interest, if there is also an optimistic scenario that putting these countries back on their feet with the right leadership is in fact achievable, then what lessons can we draw from our interventions in the Balkans, in Afghanistan, elsewhere, over the last few years? Well, I would say that the first thing is that peacekeeping can in fact work. I mentioned the 40% that lapse back into violence, but it does mean that 60% don't lapse back into violence. Economists have calculated that indeed, if peacekeeping is done in the right way, for every $1 spent on peacekeeping, $4 worth of growth and development accrue to the state in question. In other words, it does make economic sense. So therefore, what have we learned about how we can do this better? I think lesson number one is we have to do a better job of intelligence and warning. Paddy Ashdown, I mentioned him earlier, has written a very interesting book called Swords into Plowshares. He looks at 14 instances of failing states, and he shows, I think convincingly, that in only two, Croatia in 1991 and Afghanistan in 2001, it was impossible to predict that the state was going to fail. In every other case, 12 out of the 14, there were lots of warning signs along the way that we could have acted upon. And therefore, improving not simply our sort of classic intelligence, but improving our assessment, our early warning, our knowledge, I think is going to be key. Let's take the case of Yemen. When Yemen became, just over the last couple of weeks, suddenly the focus of all of the international attention, it was revealed that the State Department had only two or three people who knew anything about Yemen. Whereas Dick Holbrooke, who, as you know, is currently the special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, has 30-plus people alone just working for him on his staff. And although that's the United States, the situation is undoubtedly the same in many other capitals. We finished the Cold War with 99% of all of our intelligence services and our analysts focusing on the communist world, on the Soviet Union. We had lots and lots of Russian speakers, but almost nobody who spoke Arabic. I remember very well after the Twin Towers were attacked on 9/11 that the United States wanted to go on Al Jazeera and explain its view. They had nobody who could speak Arabic well enough to appear on TV. They had to recall a retired ambassador back to service to do those kind of things. And this is a country which has, you know, American Somalis, American Yemenis, American Saudis. It has a very diverse population that could contribute to that type of analysis. So we have to do a much, much better job of knowing about these places figuring out what's going to happen. We've even had in NATO an interesting case in the last few weeks where the assistant director of intelligence in NATO has written a paper pointing out that we use our intelligence sources to look at what the Taliban are doing, whereas for peacekeepers it's much more important to know what the local population thinks of you and what they want and what their aspirations are. And there it's almost a complete blank because we don't devote resources to that. So lesson number one, we need to anticipate better. Lesson number two, we need to use diplomacy more. If the military go in, it's a failure of sorts. It's a failure of anticipation. It's a failure of prevention. It's also increasingly expensive. I said earlier, will we have the money to do expensive after the crisis interventions in future? Not everywhere. It's key. And therefore, we have to have diplomats, senior representatives of the UN, going in, trying to negotiate solutions to avoid a crisis. For example, the role that Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the UN, played in averting a disaster in Kenya after the standoff between the Kikuyus and the Luo in the wake of the recent elections could have avoided, or probably avoided, a very major clash with massive bloodshed. The role of the UN in brokering a peace agreement between the northern and the southern halves of Sudan, although that's now quite fragile, is another example as well. We cannot, I think, ladies and gentlemen, in the 21st century be in the position that we were at the end of the 20th century, where, for example, the United States was spending nearly $500 billion a year on its military budget and only $8 billion a year on the State Department, running all of the embassies in the world. The balance between political diplomacy and the military has to be a much more even one. The third thing I think we've learned is that nothing works without security first. If you're unable to create an effective security environment, then don't expect to see any development happening very quickly. Now, what are the lessons that we've learned here? Well, I think the first lesson that we've learned is that we have to use the golden hour better. The golden hour is the honeymoon period when you first enter a country where you are seen as the liberator, naturally where your enemy is now defeated and hasn't yet reorganized or regrouped or re-equipped to oppose you. You have the support of the population. You have the goodwill. People have expectations of what you are going to bring them. It's very important to use this period productively before disillusionment sets in. Now, what does that mean? I think it means in the alliance, we are going to have a major debate about how we can increase our military assets for these tasks. In my country, the United Kingdom, this week we've seen a very interesting debate between, on the one hand, General Sir David Richards, the head of the British Army, who is arguing that the lesson of Afghanistan is we need to buy fewer nuclear submarines, fewer Tornado Typhoon Eurofighter jets or joint strike fighters, fewer tanks, fewer aircraft carriers. And we need to put far more resources into educating our soldiers in order to deal with multicultural environments. We have to put more resources into drones for intelligence collection. We have to put more resources into helicopters to move around. We have to put more resources into strategic aircraft, logistics, and these kind of things. He argues that for the price of one joint strike fighter, you can operate several more infantry battalions every year in a place such as Afghanistan, and he's no doubt right. On the other hand of the equation, though, we have Admiral Sir Mark Stanhope, also a former NATO commander, who is the head of the fleet, who is arguing, well, you know, we should not put all of our eggs in one basket. Afghanistan may not be the paradigm to come. We may have great power war once again in the future, and therefore we should make sure that we continue to invest in heavy war fighting capabilities, such as ships or tanks or aircraft or aircraft carriers. The problem is that with talk in the UK of a 20% budget cut, rightly or wrongly, with many other NATO countries cutting their budgets in the wake of the financial crisis, it's going to be increasingly difficult to do everything. We don't want to be a jack of all trades, but master of none. And so clearly, when it comes to security, making the right decisions as to where we invest our military capabilities is going to be absolutely key if we're going to be able to generate the forces we need to apply effective security. You've all heard the stories from Afghanistan about deficiencies in the number of helicopters, troops without body armour, under-resourced units which are not able to operate at night, or old aircraft blowing up in the sky because they're 40 years old and haven't been replaced, and the like. I think if we send our troops on these missions, we owe it to them to provide the best equipment that we can. The next thing I think that we've learned, ladies and gentlemen, from these failed state interventions is that we need a better comprehensive approach. The military have frequently been left doing civilian tasks for which they are ill-suited. The military security has not been backed up by development, by investment. We haven't had, if you like, at the beginning, the joint planning between the civilians and the military so that they can coordinate their efforts in a more effective way. We've tended, naturally, to focus on winning the war, and far less planning has gone into what do we do afterwards. But finding out that that is often the tricky and the more difficult phase. Winning wars has become comparatively easy. So we need a better comprehensive approach. The next thing is that clearly, and I think this is going to be one of the big developments in security, we need more civilian capabilities. You can't win these conflicts with the military alone. And yet, it's easy to find soldiers to deploy. As the EU has found, and others, it's very difficult to deploy civilians. They can be even more expensive than the military. We in the UK, for instance, we have a list of civilian elements, for judges, teachers, policemen, and so on. The trouble is that 80% of them don't work for the government, and therefore they cannot be mobilised like the military. They could say, thank you, but I don't want to go. My wife's having a baby next week. It's not a convenient time. I'd rather go there than there. A lot of effort now in the United States, in the UK, is going into what can we do to create the military, the army, the civilian equivalent, if you like, of military forces, deployable police units. For example, in the British police, should we have a career structure which is not to be on the beat in London, but to be deployed as police on training missions? In our civil service, should we not put into people's contracts, you may be deployed to Kandahar or Helmand or to a provincial reconstruction team as a normal part of your career? Should we not have a kind of equivalent of the territorial army or the National Guard of civilian reservists who, like in the United States, get a second pay packet but accept to be deployed because they have civilian skills like running elections or fixing highways or running nuclear power stations or wherever it is? I think this is going to be a significant growth area because here we are deficient. I think we need to sort out also aid and development. It's quite clear that we spend large amounts of money, but we don't get the development that we expect for that investment. Kai Eide, the UN envoy in Afghanistan, in a speech in Kabul this week, said interestingly that there were 18,000 aid projects ongoing in Afghanistan today, of which 15,000 involved less than $100,000. In other words, they weren't having a strategic impact. They were too small. Their quick reaction. They make governments feel good. You look at, have on your television, look at this road which, you know, my country has built with its development agency. It's a good photo opportunity, but does that road lead it anywhere? Does any trade go along that road? Often no. So we need to look far more at how we use the aid in larger projects, infrastructure projects, economic projects, but which are part of a long-term development strategy. We need also to develop a bigger regional approach. It's very difficult to stabilise a place like Afghanistan if you do not have the involvement of the neighbours in a constructive way. We were only successful in the Balkans when we persuaded the Croats and the Serbs to cooperate to stabilise, for example, Bosnia. And therefore, we need to pay more attention to establish regional groupings and to get the neighbours involved in a constructive rather than negative way. And then finally, we have to have a realistic plan and a realistic end state. It's not just what do our capabilities allow us to achieve, but what is the kind of end state that we can achieve, which is consistent with A, what the population of this country want, and B, which is consistent with our own strategic aims. It would help, by the way, if we have just one end state instead of what we often have, which is a whole variety of different explanations or motivations for being there, which seem to change all the time. Finally, we need to build a better institutional structure to manage these interventions in the future. I've said the UN will be the first responder. It has the most legitimacy, it has the most experience, it does the nation building as well as the peacekeeping as well. It's cheaper than NATO and the EU by far. And it often, let's face it, goes to places where many of the Western countries don't want to go. As Dag Hammarskjöld, one of the great Secretary Generals of the UN once said, the purpose of the United Nations is not to take man to heaven, but to save him from hell. That's true. But the UN needs help. It needs help with funding, it needs help with training, it needs help with transportation, it needs help with equipment. The hybrid, as you see in Chad or Zaire, or as you see with the UK in Sierra Leone a few years ago, the hybrid where Western forces help the UN peacekeepers with various functions, I think is increasingly going to be the way ahead in the future. We need also much better planning among these organisations, including starting at home between NATO and the European Union. If we actually have a plan in advance, it helps. I often consider that sometimes these interventions are handled rather like a holiday in Spain before the internet. A lot of you are too young to remember holidays in Spain before the internet. But basically what happened is that you booked your holiday. You arrived in the middle of the night to discover that all of the cars had gone from the car hire or it was closed. You had to wait for a bus to take you to your hotel. You discovered that the hotel wasn't finished and you had to go miles away to another hotel. You then discovered that the beach was miles away. And when you got there, people had already put their towels on all the deck chairs. In other words, you spent 90% of your holiday organising your holiday. And you had just about got yourself organised when it was time to come home. Now, the internet, that problem doesn't exist any longer. You go on the internet, you book your flight, you have a photo of the hotel, you book your room, you book your beach pass, your hired car, you arrive ready to go. Everything has been integrated from the outset. This is what we need to do with interventions. We need less improvisation after we've arrived, more knowledge in advance of what the tasks are, who is going to contribute what, and the ability to work together. So, ladies and gentlemen, in summary, what are the golden rules for being successful in intervening in failed or failing states? Number one, avoid the conflict if you can. It's always going to be cheaper that way. But if you can't avoid the conflict, then remember that it's not over when the fighting is finished. That's when the interesting part begins. Therefore, spend as much time planning the peace as you do in preparing for the war or the conflict that precedes it. Make sure your plan is based on proper knowledge of the country itself. Know what you're getting into. Don't do what Napoleon used to do when he said, on s'engage puis on voit. In other words, you jump in and then you find out. Sorry, Napoleon was a brilliant general. He could afford that luxury. We are not so brilliant. We need to know in advance. Don't try to fashion the country in your own image. It's about what they want, not about what you want. Leave your prejudices at home. Don't lose the golden hour, that honeymoon period when you have the population on your side. Peacekeeping is the same as lovemaking. First impressions count. you have a very short lifespan before you go from an army of liberation to an army of occupation. So use the golden hour. Dominate the security space from the start, because if you don't provide security, you don't allow NGOs or the civilian reconstruction agencies to operate, and the public become disillusioned when the benefits of peace don't arrive. Then, and I think this is true, don't worry so much about organising elections. Yes, you want democracy. It's statistically proven that democracies have higher growth rates than autocratic states. Democracy is not just good, it's also more efficient. But sometimes it's better to get the economy moving and have the rule of law first before you have elections, than to simply have an election where warlords come back in, or the winner takes all, or one ethnic group, you know, sort of gets its revenge on the other ethnic group and simply takes away the resources. So, yes, you want elections, but you don't have to have them the day after you intervene. So be sensitive to local traditions and customs. Speak with the same voice. Coordinate your effort. And, of course, you know, don't overstay your welcome. Your role is to create a sustaining peace, not a model society. As soon as the peace is sustainable, leave and let the locals determine their own future. Those are not my conclusions, I have to say. Those are the conclusions of Paddy Ashdown, Lord Paddy Ashdown, from his experience of the Balkans. And he certainly would have applied them to Afghanistan had he gone to Afghanistan as the UN representative. But I can think of no better series of laws and lessons which I think are universally applicable, to the extent that we will continue to be involved in failed and failing states. Thank you very much.
I got a question. Yes, thank you for your speech. It was great. I was wondering, are we considering that as long as a state is stable, that it is not a failing state and that we do not need to go into it? Is that what I inferred correctly from your speech?
Yeah. Absolutely. There are, of course, a number of states whose foreign policies we disagree with. But that, of course, is not a reason to intervene. We have to deal with those problems, for example, Iran's nuclear program or North Korea's nuclear program or whatever. We have to deal with those issues through other means, for example, reference to the UN Security Council, as in the case of Iran at the moment, plans to sort of tighten up the sanctions, particularly against the members of the regime, and so on and so forth. There are other methods to deal with that. And, of course, we all know that unless you can form a viable coalition of partners who support you, those sanctions or those pressures are not likely to be effective. So, no, I think as far as failed or failing states are concerned and interventions, we are dealing with a situation where it is clear that a government is committing mass human rights violations against its own people, or the government is incapable, because it's collapsed, of dealing with those massive violations against its people, where not to intervene is likely to precipitate a much greater humanitarian crisis, for instance, or where the overspill of refugees could destabilise another country. For example, Kosovo 99, I remember very well that one of the worries of NATO was that all of the literally millions of Kosovo Albanians coming out of the country would totally destabilise the neighbouring country, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, or Albania, and therefore we would have a wider a crisis in the Balkans, for instance. Now, your question, though, is a good one, because it has to be said that this responsibility to protect doctrine, which was agreed by the UN, is not universally supported. That's the least that can be said. There are many countries that still believe this is a violation of sovereignty, and that there are no circumstances in which sovereignty can be justifiably violated. It remains absolute. So they agreed, if you like, with the principle, but not to the specific implementation. And we saw on with Burma, for example, or with others, where members of the Security Council have literally said no to any international plan to intervene. So I think one of the key tasks, and I mentioned earlier this problem of legal versus legitimate, I think one of the key tasks for the international community in the years ahead is going to take this sort of theory of the responsibility to protect and try to figure out a kind of guidebook, a manual for where you apply and where you don't, in which situations you intervene. Gareth Evans, by the way, who you remember, the former Australian Prime Minister, who was here in Brussels for many years as the chairman of the International Crisis Group, he was all clear. He's written a very good book called The Responsibility to Protect, that one of the problems is that we gave many countries the impression that interventions are only military. Only military. I sense that one of the... and I've spoken, I have to say, today, yes, essentially about military interventions. But I think, in all fairness, I have to stress that I think one of the ways in which we will have the responsibility to protect accepted by non-Western countries will be by showing that it can be done by other means, economic means, sending civilian envoys, you know, asking a country like Burma to accept that it has to receive a UN envoy. They refused to receive the UN envoy, for instance, you know, who came to mediate. Because I think one of the problems we do have at the moment, I think your question is a good one, is we've conveyed the impression that, you know, it's all or nothing. It's a sort of a massive military Iraq-style force coming in, or nothing at all. And we have to try to use other means as well. So, yes, at the back.
Thank you very much for this lecture. My question is in relation with NATO and the new strategic concept that is ongoing. Regarding interventions and the comprehensive approach that more and more people are talking about, what would you see or foresee as being the future role of NATO?
The first thing I would say is that we've got to make, I think, it clear in the strategic concept to our publics that interventions are not going to stop with Afghanistan. At the moment, there is, as you know, a great deal of weariness with Afghanistan. Let's be frank, everybody knows that. There's a sense, oh, well, the Balkans was comparatively easy in the 1990s. You know, the problem for NATO was to decide to use its military capabilities. Once we used the military capabilities, a couple of days later, Dayton in Bosnia. In Kosovo, a couple of days later, war was over. And then we had peacekeeping where, as you know, in the Balkans, we rotated about 1 million NATO soldiers in the 1990s. Not one was killed. Not one person was killed. The danger in the Balkans was jogging or traffic accidents, not hostile fire. So in the 90s, there was a sense of it was war without tears. You know, it was easy. You know, technology on our side allowed easy victories. The population was happy to see us painless. Now, of course, with Afghanistan, I hardly need to tell you this, it's all very different. Last year we had nearly 600 casualties and deaths in the NATO forces. That's 40% up on the year before. And you see every day now we have attacks and casualties. The costs I mentioned are uppermost. And therefore, there is in some circles a sense, well, OK, we can't leave Afghanistan. We're in. We have to finish the job. It would be a damage to NATO's credibility to leave. But once we finish Afghanistan, then no more interventions. You know, there's this famous Second World War movie called A Bridge Too Far. And many people think Afghanistan, that's a war too far. Let's stop. And you have people in the security base saying, no, let's have a different tactic. Let's pull up the drawbridge. In other words, let's spend all this money that we're spending on Afghanistan, on border security, you know, on having databases of potential terrorist suspects, stopping them from coming into our countries. Let's give all the money to the intelligence services, to the police. So it's like football, you know, where you've had a team which is trying to attack the other goal and says, no, let's just defend our goal now. You know, that's it. I personally think that one of the things that we must do in a strategic concept is to get the message out, look, Afghanistan is difficult, but the lesson is not to stop doing these missions. The lesson is to learn to do them better. through some of the things that I mentioned in my lecture. We've got to be more effective. We've got to have, as I say, you know, better joint planning, better comprehensive approach, more civilian assets, a more realistic plan, all of those kind of things. Because if you look around the world and the prevalence of failed or failing states, it's clear that Afghanistan will not be the last intervention. There are going to be many, many others. And so, to my mind, that is the political objective, to first get the message out that, you know, there will be other Afghanistans. This is the paradigm for the 21st century, that these extremist organisations will exploit these situations as failed states. We also have the impacts of climate change, of droughts, you know, of freak weather conditions, of population movements, of like Haiti, hurricanes, where these states clearly are going to need some international intervention to assist. And so this, to my mind, despite all of the emphasis on terrorism or energy security or climate change, the things that we were talking about in previous lectures, failed states, to my mind, will remain the dominant paradigm, the dominant issue, the dominant problem. And so that's the answer. We have to learn to do it better and therefore obviously try to do our best to make Afghanistan end for NATO on a positive note, so that our public opinion will be more ready to countenance other Afghanistans in the future, rather than believe that we can sort of protect ourselves through a kind of isolationist pulling up of the drawbridge, because I don't believe we can. We've seen, you know, in the United States, that with all of the massive spending on intelligence, with all of, you know, the lists of suspects, even with lots of warnings, terrorists still find a way of getting through our armour. And therefore, to sort of deal with the problem at source is still, to my mind, the best security policy.
First of all, thank you, Mr. Shi, for the lecture today. My question to you would be, do you reckon that for Afghanistan, we need a refurbished strategy, so to say, with a redefined mission, purpose and value, so we can more effectively approach governments in Berlin, in London, elsewhere, and hence stimulate more cooperation and input to Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think the strategy from the beginning has been the right one. The problem has been the lack of resources. And often what happens is, when there is a lack of resources, people think it's the strategy that needs to be revised. But you spend a lot of time revising your strategy and you come out with exactly the same objectives as you had before, because they're fairly self-evident. You need to build Afghan security forces. You need to build an effective government structure. In a country like Afghanistan, with different, very strong local traditions and different groups, tribal groups, ethnic groups, you need a high degree of decentralization. You need cooperative neighbors. I mean, this is not rocket science, frankly. It's like me. I know I need to lose weight. It's obvious. The question is not, do I come up with a new strategy, but, you know, do I have the willpower to stop eating and take exercise? And I think that it's really been a question of trying to do it on the cheap, under-resourcing. I mean, when NATO went in 2003, we went in with 3,000 troops, essentially to Kabul. We left large amounts of the country without any international presence for many years. We underestimated the strength of the Taliban. Because they disappeared, we believed that that meant they were defeated. But disappearing doesn't mean that you're defeated or you've gone away, as we're now discovering. We were too slow, probably, in engaging Pakistan and many of the regional neighbours. We were too late in starting the training programme for the Afghan National Army, Afghan National Police. We gave ownership to the Afghans, yes, but perhaps without sufficient monitoring of what they were doing to make sure that they were actually capable of running economic programs, delivering aid, that they were fighting narcotics or corruption and the rest. So to some degree, we are doing now things that, to my mind, we could have been doing and should have been doing from the outset in 2003. We largely sacrificed that famous golden hour of which I was speaking. But, you know, better late than never, huh? Better late than never. I think that the military situation will be much better because you can do a lot in terms of presence with 30,000 troops. But I think the key thing is obviously going to be the mobilisation of the civilian resources. We have one single command structure on the military side, but not a single command structure on the civilian side, where there are a host of different players and different actors. There's a conference in London next week, and I think the key thing there is going to be to actually rationalise the civilian side and have one person who is responsible for the coordination. I generally believe that these missions work best when one person is the supremo, who is in charge. Everybody answers to that person. He or she sets the priorities, brings the various actors together every day behind a common strategy, a common message, is the focal point in dealing with the local government. We haven't had that. I mean, President Karzai, quite rightly, often complains that every day he has 30 different international envoys, all giving him a different message. There are 14 different programs in Kabul dealing with the reform of the judiciary and so on. There's very, very fragmented effort indeed. We need to bring that together. I think the third aspect of doing a better job is to make sure that now President Karzai has been re-elected, that he really does deliver on his promises, not just good speeches. But there is real delivery on promises in terms of, you know, appointing good ministers, fighting corruption, all of these kind of things. Much tougher conditionality, if you like, on the Afghans themselves. So I sense that, you know, we have the right answers, but we've just got to be better organised in delivering what we've promised the Afghan people that we're going to deliver to them. Just one thing, an opinion poll shows that despite all of our mistakes, and there are many, and despite the frustrations of the Afghan people, an opinion poll last week showed that 80% still want ISAF to stay, still support the West. Only 2% want the Taliban to come back. So, it's like Churchill on democracy, the worst of all systems, except for all of the others. Thank you very much.